Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you today? I hope you're doing well. Hope you're having a great baking day. Today on the show, I talk to Amy Emberling. If you don't know Amy, she's amazing. She is the managing partner of Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Yeah. And we had a really good chat. We had a great talk about all kinds of stuff. And that's coming up in a few minutes. I'm excited to share this one with you. That was a really good talk. So what's new in your world? I hope you made it through Mother's Day okay. If you did specials, I hope the specials were well received. Mother's Day is a bit of a goofy holiday in our household because Cindy's never been a fan of the day. The tradition of, you know, getting all duded up and going out for brunch in her mind put more stress on moms than it did on anyone else. And so we've always really low-keyed Mother's Day around here, but we did have Zoom calls with the kids. And what else did we do? We walked up to Victoria Public Market on Sunday because there was a pop-up from a place in town here called Goodside Baking. And I know Haley from Goodside, but there's three chefs got together and they do this pop-up every other Sunday or a couple Sundays a month. And they make cream puffs and eclairs and they are brilliant. Like we're talking amazing, delicate, super high-end, beautiful to look at, even better to eat cream puffs that you pre-order. Or in this case, we just lined up and there were about 15 people in line when we got there just before they opened and got a couple cream puffs. And there was a really good sandwich place that does porchetta sandwiches. So we picked up a sandwich to go. And so Mother's Day brunch was back at the house. Porchetta sandwiches and cream puffs. It was good. It was very, very good. And it's so cool here. The patisserie is something that I don't have a lot of experience in. And I still, my eyes kind of bug out when I see the really good stuff being made and then try and figure out how they come up with the different flavor combinations to make it work. Like this one cream puff that we had was, you know, passion fruit and lemon curd with milk chocolate whip on the top of this thing. And it was just really, really cool because, you know, I'm like, oh, if it's chocolate, then I would put chocolate with chocolate. I wouldn't think to put it with anything else because just more chocolate, please. But it's cool to get the contrast of flavors in something, like in one bite, where you know that the person that made it really thought about, how am I going to put this together? And so, yeah, it was really, really good. It's funny because my friend Patty out in New Brunswick, who used to work with us at Orange Boot Bakery in Saskatchewan, has opened up her place. And she's been on the show. She was on, I think, the second show we ever did. And she's an amazing pastry chef, absolutely amazing pastry chef. And we didn't make much for pastries at all, really, when she was working with us at Orange Boot. And so now to follow her on Instagram at Chess Piece Cafe there and watch what they're coming out with, I'm just amazed. And so, yeah, I need to get out and actually taste some of this stuff. But yeah, patisserie is a whole other adventure. You don't see it as often here, like it done really, really well as, you know, say in Paris or something like that. But when you do stumble across a place that's really making the good stuff, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's interesting to me. I wonder if that's another trend that's going to be coming up, like, you know, in these towns that are embracing, you know, the artisanal bakers and, you know, bread and viennoiserie and that kind of thing, if they're also going to be embracing high-end patissiers at some point. That'd be cool. What else is going on? I should give you a chair update just because this is craziness. And for any of you bakers that are thinking of shipping product, if you're going to ship around the country, really take a good look at who you're hiring to ship and make sure that they're taking the direct route. Because I'll tell you this story. I bought a chair online. Like, you get these, you know, ads. If you ever search for an ergonomic chair, every Instagram, you know, or feed of any kind is going to be full of ads for ergonomic chairs and standing desks and that kind of thing. And so I bought a chair from a company called Effie Desk that's in Vancouver, you know, and I think they're really cool. I have no problem with Effie Desk. I think they're great and they're very responsive, but I think they made a fatal mistake with who they hired for their shipping. So I order this chair. There's a bit of a delay in getting the chair because everything's made in China. And so they had to, I don't know if it was a Suez Canal thing or just a delay, but it was a couple of weeks before they got a new shipment of chairs into their warehouse in Surrey, BC. Now, Surrey, BC is 110 kilometers from where I live. So let's say 50 miles, okay? And get the note, it's coming this day. Get another note from them, it's shipped. Can't wait till you get your chair. Should be there in, you know, 1 to 2 days, but really, you know, 3 to 4 business days is their standard promise. So, okay, fine. Here's a tracking number, no problem. And I see that it gets picked up, and I'm just saying, all right, they're going to get on the ferry. I'll have it the next day. And it doesn't show up, and it doesn't show up. And I start looking at the tracking, and the chair went from Surrey, British Columbia to Etobicoke, Ontario, which is central Ontario, you know, outside of Toronto. And it's in the distribution hub there, and now it's been picked up from the distribution hub and is allegedly on its way and was supposed to come yesterday. Now, the only problem with this is that Etobicoke, Ontario is over 4,000 kilometers in the wrong direction from the warehouse in Surrey. So instead of going 100 kilometers to the west, they went 4,000 kilometers east, and now it's coming 4,100 kilometers west to come to my front door. And instead of taking like 2 days or, you know, being here the next day, we're at about 10 days and counting. and so all I'm saying is, if you're going to use the same shipping company, you don't want to be sending perishables, because I can live without a chair. I'm fine. But it's like if you're shipping bread around and it goes 8,000 kilometers out of its way to get to your place, you know, you might just want to inquire. That's all I'm saying. You might want to ask a few questions and not just buy the cheapest one. So that's my little chair adventure. Effie Desk in their marketing really prides themselves on being green and sustainable. They have a high-end standing desk that I didn't buy. I can't afford it. And it's all made from recycled chopsticks, and it's super, super environmentally friendly. And I think any benefit of that is out the window if you're going to add 8,000 kilometers to your route as you ship this thing over to the island. So maybe that's just me. But I think it's a funny story. And in this modern world, how you'd ever conceive of a situation where you'd send it to the distribution hub 4,000 kilometers away. Oh, well. All right, onto the good stuff here. Amy Emberling is the managing partner of Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And if you don't know about Zingerman's, I'm going to tell you a couple of things before we start the call. So first off, Amy's been part of the Bakehouse since the very beginning, you know, or almost the very beginning. And the Bakehouse is part of the Zingerman's family of companies that started with the deli, then opened up a bakehouse, then opened up a whole bunch of other businesses in this sort of family of businesses model, including training, like a business training and leadership training and employee training, that kind of stuff, which is very popular as well. And this model of, well, we've got one business and we're not going to keep expanding the business, but we are going to support the starting of a new business under the one umbrella and kind of grow that way is really fascinating to me. So we talk a bit about that. And also about Amy's career, because she's been in the field a very long time and has been with at Zingerman's and done other things over her career. All right, so here we go with Amy Emberling from Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Nice to meet you.
Yes, nice to meet you, a fellow Canadian.
Yeah, yeah. I heard that you grew up in Nova Scotia, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Whereabouts? So,
on Cape Breton Island in Sydney.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I've been out there twice in my life and absolutely loved it. It just yeah. When we were talking about leaving Saskatchewan, that was sort of a we're going to a coast, but are we going west or are we going east? You know, and we thought kind of hard about it.
Well, you probably made the right choice for some reasons. Yeah, I've never been to Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. My brother actually lived in Saskatoon for a couple of years.
Oh, cool. But,
Yeah.
Well, it's neat. I didn't know that until I was out there, especially out in Halifax, and we were down around the harbor, and there were a bunch of folks coming up on sailboats up from Boston. And this was like, you know, a thing that's done, right? And, mm-hmm. and this whole north-south connection is really strong out there. Right. It's stronger than a east-west kind of connection.
It's so nice to hear you say that, because sometimes I tell people that. And I feel funny about it. It means my experience, but it's interesting to hear you say it. So actually, yes, in my life, we spent much more time going up down the coast. You know, we would go to Maine for summer vacation. We had family in Boston and New York. And so, yes, that was the migration pattern. Yeah. Although, of course, there were lots of people growing up on Cape Breton Island, which is, you know, relatively challenged economically for most of my life.
Yep.
Many people, when I was very little, they were going to Toronto for economic reasons.
Sure.
But then when I was probably middle school and high school, then they were going to places like Calgary because it was booming.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think people's more natural inclination mm-hmm. was to go down the coast.
The best school principal that our kids ever had was from Marguerite on Cape Breton.
Yeah.
And he said, they were in such rough shape. They were so poor that when they moved west, and they said, now, you know, somebody bought the house for, you know, pennies and is running a booming bed and breakfast 20 years later, you know, and he said, they'll let me spend a lot of money to stay in my old room. But it's like, that's the, you know, for me, it was, it would have been later, but when I was working, for the phone company in Saskatchewan, there was a big exodus from Newfoundland. A bunch of young guys moved out, you know, in I'd say the mid to late 90s, you know, and settled in Saskatchewan and stuff. And, you know, cause it's like this, you go where the jobs are, you know, unfortunately, such a resource based place that, you know, you can't bring it to you sometimes.
Yeah.
So cool. Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's fascinating to me. Like this whole, I don't know, we'll get to baking, but it's like, as I'm learning about how borders are drawn anywhere in the world really has nothing to do with how people move, you know? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Fun stuff. So cool. Well, I have to say, I've been a fan of Zingerman's and the Zingerman Bakehouse since long before I ever made it out there to see you guys. I don't know why. While I was working, I think I remember why, because I was working at SaskTel, and in their corporate library, they had one of the early Zingerman's Guide to Customer Service kind of books on the shelves. And I was still like thinking, oh, you know, I'm working this corporate job. I really want to be a baker.
And it's like, oh, you know, here's a crossover point. So I think I might have been the guy that signed that book out the most, just for all the little stories, you know, the little deli and bakehouse stories. And it's like, oh, it can be done. So
funny. Well, I'm glad that we're finally getting to talk. I've known about your podcast for a while now.
Oh wow!
And cool. I knew all about it, so it was fun when I saw that email. I'm like, sure, I would love to meet you. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
So how did you get involved in baking then? I guess, you know, from Cape Breton, and then I heard you came down to college and stuff, but then what made the food shift for you?
Well, I have always been interested in baking and as a child and cooking and eating out. In Cape Breton, that was not always that. I mean, there were only a few places to go in Sydney when I was a kid. And I looked forward to going to them and bothered my parents a lot about going. And so, you know, I joke with people. And it sounds kind of corny, but I think like being a baker or being in the food business is really a little bit of a calling for me. Mm-hmm. I wish at times that my calling had been to be a hedge fund manager, but unfortunately it was not. Yeah. And I think that I have found that I do my best if I just do what I am really, really interested in. And so I was always interested, and I baked as a child or as a young person. And then I went to college and, you know, I was really interested in food. I actually took my senior year. I took like the local Rec and Ed class in cooking, and everybody thought I was really strange. Like, what's wrong with you? It wasn't fashionable then. I graduated in 1988. The Food Network, just for a milestone, started in 1992. Okay. And it was not cool. There were a few famous chefs, but not that many.
Yeah.
It was still kind of a low life. You know, it's what you have to do if, you know, just to make some money, or if you have an addiction problem, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, but then I came to Ann Arbor because my husband was going to go to grad. He was my boyfriend at the time, wanted to go to graduate school here.
Oh, okay.
And I thought I could go to school again. I could become a lawyer. Or I'll get a PhD in sociology or something, but I just want to have some fun. And so I got a job in a restaurant. And that was pretty much the end. So I worked in some restaurants. I then went to cooking school. And then I came back, worked in a couple of more places. And Mark, you know, they're not always great places to work, restaurants.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever worked in a restaurant.
Have you? Very briefly. After I had my bakery, so it doesn't really count. Like a sort of, you know, when someone says, well, we'd like to have your bread here, can you come in? You just, you're watching. You're watching the mayhem. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's not always such a great place to work.
Yeah.
I kind of realized I'm not very good at not being treated decently.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, maybe this isn't going to work for me. But I was at Zingerman's Deli. And I somehow, you know, this was before social media, but you know, there were newspapers and you read things, and I had heard that through the grapevine, it was a great place to work. And the food was really good there. I didn't want to make sandwiches. It was just not that interesting to me. Not that they're not great sandwiches.
Right.
So I saw one of the founders and I recognized him, and I uncharacteristically actually asked him, hey, where should I go and work? And he said, oh, my friend Frank is opening up a bakery. Why don't you go try to work with him?
Oh, wow.
And, you know, at that time, there weren't that many artisan bakeries around the country. Nope. There were some.
Yep.
And there certainly were not very many in Michigan. There were bakeries, but they were mom and pop, or they, I don't know, maybe didn't seem that great, whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't even think of it. I just thought I could only work in a restaurant. And so that's how it all started. That was Zingerman's Bakehouse. It was 1992. And I went and spoke to Frank, and who was my partner here until December 31st of 2020. Yeah. And that's how it all got going.
Oh, so cool. So cool. Yeah, it's neat because, you know, I think we're pretty close to the same age, because like I graduated university in 89, I got married in 92, but I did the office job for the long time, for like the bug to, the making the leap to working in a kitchen or working in a bakery was took me a lot longer to get up the nerve to do that. It's funny because, but I remember even like in the times before, it's like whenever there was like something going on at, you know, at my in-law's church and there was an opportunity to work in the big church kitchen, you know, it's like, okay, I'm in, right? It's like, just let me work in the space, you know? Yeah. So yeah, so cool. Yeah.
Well, I sort of did it a little, I followed my passion a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I got married really young. Sounds like you did too. Was not typical of amongst my friends. I had a child, our son, when I was 24.
Okay.
Also not typical. Neither my husband nor I really were at all. My husband didn't finish graduate school until our son was 5 and our daughter was 2. Okay.
Gotcha.
So we thought it'll all work out.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can do this. And then finally, you know, it was a little hard.
Yeah.
And it was before the time when people would like do something hard for a year and then write a book about it. I did it. I managed to live something yeah. really hard, but I didn't realize I could have written a book about it. So eventually we ended up in Manhattan and my husband had a job there. And I thought, oh my God, we're not going to make it. And so I did go to business school because I thought I can't be it. It was really nice, but I need to be serious and rational now, you know, with a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, get with it. And and then I worked in a consulting firm for about 10 months.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's just, it was not for me.
Yeah.
It was not for me. It was wonderful people, decent work, whatever. And so then back to the passion.
At least you knew, you're not going to be standing around the bench, wondering. It's like, no, I did it.
No, I did it. I did. I spent a lot of money going to business school, which I do believe I learned a lot and it's been helpful. But and I don't regret that part of it. But by the time I moved back to Ann Arbor in 19, so I worked at the bakery from 92 to 96.
Okay.
And I came back in 2000 to be a partner. By the time I came back, I had made quite a challenging situation to come out of. But you know what? It has all worked out.
Yeah.
It's a good story. Now it's a good story.
And you can still write
still
the
book. Married. I can still write the book. I'm still married. My children love me. It's okay. Yeah.
So in the first wave of Ed Zingerman's, like when the bakehouse first started, was it always going to be a part of Zingerman's, like right from day one? Or was it like you and Frank start this thing and then fold it in?
No. It was always going to be part of Zingerman's. So Paul and Ari, the founders of Zingerman's, were friends with Frank. And Frank was a business partner of Paul's in a different business. And they said, hey, we want to open up a bakery because we can't get the bread that we want. Would you like to do it with us? Cool. So it was the second of all the Zingerman's businesses. And and really sort of the test for whether we could have this community of businesses. Would it work to have this model?
Yeah. And so right from the start, it's like, okay, well, we're here. We're going to supply the deli and we're going to go further afield as well. Right. To make the thing work. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the idea was to be a wholesale bakery.
Gotcha.
To only make artisan bread.
Mm-hmm.
To be the main supplier for Zingerman's Deli and maybe have some other customers. Frank said he wanted to have, in his mind at the beginning, it was to have a relatively small business where he could keep everybody happy.
Uh-huh.
and so we didn't grow incredibly quickly. He has been a really great leader for us. He's very deliberate. And he incredibly dedicated to wanting to make great food over wanting to make a lot of food.
Gotcha.
And we are now a decent sized bakery relative to, you know, some people might say we're really big. We're not at all the biggest artisan bakery in the United States in any way, but we're we're not just a 5-person crew.
Right.
But over time, you know, it's been 28 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Different ones of us have had different interests and things have grown. And then the other thing that happens is that people come to you and they want to buy from you. And it's not, people don't take it well if you tell them that we're not, oh, I'm sorry, we're not going to sell to you.
Yeah.
What do you mean? This is America. You're not going to sell to us?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You don't have capacity. You don't want to be bigger. Oh, it must be that you don't think we're good enough or something. So, you know, if people want to buy from you, it's difficult not to figure out a way to do it.
Yeah.
So we've gotten bigger. But
that's so cool. Yeah. Because, you know, I was talking just this week with some bakers that are just starting out, you know, sort of, you know, it's me and an assistant, I've got my space. And so they're figuring out how to scale up, you know, they're figuring out how to make more. And at that level, it's hurting them in their soul when they sell out early and customers are like, I stood in line and now you're out. And especially with COVID, everything's in line, you know? So, you know, I've been in line half an hour to find out through the window that you're out or, you know, that kind of stuff. And it tears them to bits, you know? And it's like, it sounds like that never really goes away. No matter what size you are, there's always that tension between how much you can do and what people want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Just this week, suddenly something's going on, you know, it's spring and maybe with people being vaccinated, we're getting calls from customers that we haven't had for 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. We'd like to start up again. And we look at each other. Okay. What do you think? Do we want to do this? You know, do we want to do this or not?
Yeah. Well, and, right. and how, I'm just trying to get a sense of like the, and I don't even know what the metric is, but sort of how big is the bake house now? Like with maybe how big is your crew or
sure.
how big is that kind of thing?
I can help. So in the very beginning, there were 8 of us.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was kind of big. It was like a startup in restaurants, you know, you often overhire.
Yeah.
People will not work out. Probably we needed maybe 6 people or whatever.
Right.
There were 8 of us. We made 5 kinds of bread and we had 1 customer, Zingerman's Deli. I think in the first year of business in 1992, maybe we did $500,000 of sales.
Wow.
Now, you know, we scaled back because of the pandemic, but we probably have about 120 employees.
Gosh.
We go around the clock, not baking constantly, but there's someone here cleaning or delivering or...
Yeah.
Fixing something or baking. And we have about, 70 wholesale customers or so.
Gotcha.
We bake about 4,000 or 5,000 loaves of bread a day, but then we have a whole pastry kitchen and a cake area and we teach classes. And we have our own retail shop, which we had never been, you know, wasn't in the initial vision, but you're in an area, people smell what you're making. They want to buy it. And
yeah.
So that's happened.
Yeah. That's what I visited a couple of years ago was the retail shop that sort of like Zingerman's Row in that area. Right?
Exactly.
All the stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about to talk about a little bit was how you've grown in terms of the product line. Cause you mentioned it already but it's this picture I have in my mind is like somebody wants quite strongly to make a new thing. And it's like, okay, how are we going to make that happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, how we decide to grow comes, you know, from a few different directions.
Okay.
Sometimes there's someone in the bakery, one of us who's just really excited about something, which is often the case. I mean, that's why most of us are in this business because we love to bake and so we want to make something new, you know, we don't want to always make exactly the same thing. We want to learn more. So that's one direction. So that happens. Then sometimes some of the Zingerman's businesses, we get a new business that starts. They have a slightly different market or, you know, a theme or something that they're doing. And so they ask us to make something. And that's pretty much we're going to do it if they ask us to do it. And then sometimes we have some wholesale customers who want something in particular. That is not typical. We don't typically respond to that. It's mainly driven by what we want to make or what one of the other Zingerman's businesses wants to make.
Right.
Like, for instance, we have a cake area. Well, at a certain point, I thought, I love decorated cakes. I'm not a cake decorator, but I love them. I love celebration cakes. And so to me, it was like, how can you have a bakery? I know it's not bread, but
I hear about
other baked things. How can we have a bakery and not have these celebration cakes? So that's how that got going.
Right on. Yeah.
Does that give you an idea?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
It's mainly driven, vision driven from us. We are trying to make particular kinds of food or do particular things. Like right now, you know, as many artisan bakers are very interested in freshly milled grain, right. Mm-hmm. That completely fits with what we care about, doing historical things, traditional ways. Like, yes, great. Let's get a mill. Let's try to learn how to mill. Let's try to be a positive player in developing the local grain economy here in Michigan. Lots of people are doing it or mm-hmm. trying to participate in different ways. Let's participate in the way that we can be most effective. So that's kind of the main thing that we're working on now. We're not developing so many new things, but reformulating lots of things that we're making with this new knowledge that we have,
sure.
and new skill that we have.
Sure. Well, and with the size that you are, kind of the size and the, I don't know, the solidity, I guess, you know, because you've been there for a while, you're an institution. That's an important part in a lot of that growth of the new stuff on the economy side, right? Because you've got the tiny guys that can kind of push the envelope in their way. But then something as simple, I guess, as contracting with farmers and that, or contracting with grain suppliers, because you can take more, right?
Right. I think we can really help in a couple of ways. We can really help everybody, the bakers, everyone, by trying to develop the market, because we have the capacity to do a lot of education and helping get consumers to understand what's valuable. And so, yes, you need to have a market or none of this will really matter. We also have a little financial flexibility. So we, for over 10 years, have sort of tried to contract with local farmers and take some of the risk out of them trying to grow some of these things by saying, you know, we'll take the risk, you know, we'll pay for the supplies, we'll pay for the lost sales that you're going to have, so that this is not so scary for you. And we can buy in bigger volume for people who are doing it well. There's a mill, I don't know if you know it, in Southern Illinois called Janie's Mill.
Okay. No, I haven't.
They're really great. You might look into them.
Yeah.
They are selling to a lot of people, and I'm hoping that the quantity that we're buying of some of the things that they're making is helpful to them. You know, we're buying hundreds of pounds of certain things from them on a weekly basis.
Right.
So I do think that there's a role that we can play, and that might be unique to us because of being decently established.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yep.
Was there ever a time when in the life of the bakehouse where it was like, I'm not sure if we're going to make it? is there ever like a worrying, you know, I feel bad even asking in 2021, but because it might've been 6 months ago and too close.
Right. Right. Well, so definitely last spring.
Yeah.
You know, nobody knew about these PPP loans and the government bailing people out. And right at the beginning, the first couple of weeks, and thinking about, are we going to have to close the doors? Definitely, I thought, oh, wow, are we not going to make it? And we were talking to local community members who have a lot of resources and trying to line up funding in case all of Zingerman's was going to need some in order to survive. So definitely the bakery in the very beginning, I was worried. By May or June, I was no longer worried. The bakery overall, probably not to that degree. Now, there have been areas of the bakery that we've almost shut several times.
Okay.
So bread worked really, really well for us. And then after we were making bread for just a couple of years, the founders of the deli said, hey, why don't you, you know, start to make sweet things? Because at the delicatessen, we make this thing and that thing, but we don't really have the capacity to make it, and you're doing a good job. And so we built a pastry kitchen. Well, that pastry kitchen just bled money for years. Mm-hmm. it's a very different business. Now, some people don't understand how you can do bread and they think they've managed to make money at pastry. For some reason, for years, we weren't making it work. And so we thought about closing that several times. Right. And there was, you know, there was the bread bakers were always mad at the pastry makers because they were ruining this business, and the bread bakers were the stars and the pastry makers were the, you know, the terrible rejects that were sapping money from the business. So that went on for quite a while. So I think, you know, that was a big concern. And we've worked through that. You know, we've been hit by dietary changes.
Right.
You know, I've worried about the long-term health of this business because of, you know, before gluten-free, there was, you know, the sort of carbohydrates are bad with the Atkins diet.
Yeah.
And then just low carb in general. And now the gluten issue and low fat in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so that has always worried me about the sort of the longevity of the bakery. Sort of more like a slow and painful death. And and our sales have definitely in bread have definitely decreased because of that. I mean, restaurants don't put bread on the table in the same way as they used to. So a whole, you know, restaurants used to be a good market for us. No, it just sort of depends. You know, maybe one or there, but
yeah.
So that has been a challenge over the
years. Yeah. So you actually have seen the spikes when the new fad takes off, or I guess the dips then. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then now with vegan, you know, bread is great for vegan, but the sweet things that we're making are not so great. Yep. And so, you know, how are we going to negotiate that? What should we be doing? We still want to be artisan and traditional. Can we find traditional things that are naturally vegan or naturally gluten-free? Gluten-free is easier. So those are challenges that we are constantly facing.
Yeah. Yeah. The staying in step with your customer base and what their expectations are. Hey, it's, I sure felt it at a small scale where like in my retail bakery where you tried to do your best. And so I bought local whenever I could, I bought organic whenever I could, but I'd get beat up from a few people, the vocal few that, you know, of course, those are the only people you listen to when you're starting. And it was like, you know, you're making this, sourdough, roasted garlic sourdough, but your garlic isn't organic. And it's like, right. And it's not local. Yes. I'm in Saskatchewan. You're right. Those 2 weeks in August, if I wanted to like spend all my profits, I could buy the garlic when it came fresh. Right. You know, it's, but that's, I guess that's life. It's a constant education, you know, in both directions, constant learning and constant education. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And sort of sticking to your vision while also dealing with all of these changes about what people think is healthy and good for the environment. You know, at the beginning in 92, it was enough to be making things with what we referred to as real ingredients.
Yeah.
So the fact that it wasn't a mix and that you could pronounce all of the ingredients and you knew what they were and you could find them in your own home.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
Yeah.
But now it's, you know, are they local? Are they organic? Are they GMO?
Yeah.
Is it freshly milled? Right.
Yeah. And so how do you stick to your vision while, or stick to those intentions while remaining open enough to adjusting as you learn more as well, right? That's the balance.
Yeah.
Great position to be in. Like, I always think it's better to be in the position where you get to make those decisions, even though you're under pressure, but it doesn't, I guess what I'm hearing is it doesn't end. It just continues. it just evolves.
I don't think it ends, but that's the good thing, because you always have something to do, right? It's challenging, it's engaging, and it's
and,
never
and how about you, Amy, like in terms of what your days were like versus what they're like now, like how's your kind of journey through Zingerman's evolved?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at the beginning, I was working on the floor all the time.
Yeah.
And then even when I came back in 2000 to be a partner, I was working on the floor probably 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now I probably am working in the kitchens and the bread bakery more like 20% of my time.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously that has changed and I spend a lot more of my time thinking about marketing, product development, training managers, continuing to educate myself and the team so that we are mm-hmm. relevant, but, you know, working with everybody to have a vision. So doing a lot of the strategic work. And then also for me personally, you know, I came back to be a partner, but Frank was here and he's 11 years older than I am and more experienced. And so he was the senior partner. And so I had a lot to learn for a long time. And then we operated more as equals probably mm-hmm. for the last 10 years or so. And now all of a sudden he's gone.
Right.
And so now it's a different thing again. I'm now the senior person. Which is a very funny position for me. I'm the youngest of four. I never really want to, you know, I like being the little kid playing with the big kids, not like being the big kid, but okay, I need to adjust to that. And on a personal level, you know, I'm really planning for my succession because you know, I'm 55.
Mm-hmm.
I may want to, you know, we said we're almost the same age or the same.
Yeah.
You know, I may retire in a decade. A decade is not that long in order to get other people prepared. It's, you know, I think I'm a little early but it's on my mind.
Sure.
And trying to think about new partners and preparing them and what skills are on the team now or aren't on the team and what can we do for people that they'll want to stay and who wants ownership? Does that matter or not? And so a lot of my time recently because of Frank's departure and has been thinking about those things.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the first run through with Frank leaving. And even if you've got time for the second, is like whoever succeeds you is not going to have been there since opening day. Right.
Right.
And that's going to be different, you know? So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I'm the only one left. Opening day.
but that's the, I don't know. That's the beautiful thing about business and is I've been thinking a bit about this idea of legacy that the vision might start with Frank or might start with you and Frank, but it's at the point now where it's held by a lot more people than just you two. That's a very good thing. That's a sign of maturity of the organization that it's like, okay, you can, you know, I talked a few weeks ago with two of your proteges, if you will, at least through the Zing Train training, Jen and Ann in Colorado at Hot Tomato Pizza. Like that's how we got connected up and they just started talking about how, you know, they're 15 years in and they are for the first time getting serious about, well, what is the vision? What is the legacy? And how do we shift it away from being just inside of us mm-hmm. to being outside of us? And I was really touched when I heard that because it really, and they were crediting the work that they've done with you and the Zing Train group on that. It just really had an impact on me because it's like that. It just seems like that's an actual tangible step in the evolution of the business. It's like when you're now able to even take a few hours to start thinking about that and start working towards that.
Right. And I think from an organizational level, we have done that. Zingerman's Bakehouse is not about me.
No. Right.
And,
yeah.
Right. And it's not about Frank. And we have tons of people working on things and understanding how to vision and write goals and action strategic mm-hmm. plans and do the budgeting. So that's good. But there are still things that probably I drive that someone else needs to be able to do. But it's a strange thing though. Yeah. It's a little bit like, you know, I mean, Frank hasn't died, but it's like, you know, when your parents die, it's like, oh my gosh, now solely me here, whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Right.
Yeah. But things are going, you know, I had to write a little note to the staff. I'm like, well, things are going well, even though Frank, you know, we've done his departure well. He's happy and healthy. Mm-hmm. And we're doing fine because he taught us a lot of stuff and they're ingrained in the culture and it's been systematized and we can go on. He's built in. He's built into the culture now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I know that you are teaching as well as running the bake shop now, like through Zing Train and that kind of stuff. I'm curious about that and what that's been like for you and what gets your interest there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think as a leader in the business, I spend a lot of my time teaching, trying to develop the managers. And so Zing Train, it's just great to, I think I learn the material so much better when I have to teach it, especially to an outside group. So I like it because of that. Mm-hmm. I like to teach through Zing Train or sometimes in our own school bake because I get to meet a lot of people and it's very energizing for me also. You know, one of the things over the years, at times I go through periods of not being entirely excited about what I'm doing every day.
Sure. Well, yeah.
Right? Oh, and,
being human. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, oh, really? So a manager's having a problem with somebody who's not coming to work on time. Okay. Been through that about 40 times already. You want to talk about that? Okay. Very exciting. So it really helps to energize me to meet other people, to be asked different questions, to discuss what we profess to do here and hear them try to figure out how it would work in their organization, different contexts. So I think that's generally why I do it and love to share. I mean, Zingerman's is all about, you know, sort of open source on everything that we do.
Yeah. Are you working, with business people and leaders from outside of the baking world as well, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So most of the people who come to Zing Train are not bakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they could be in healthcare. They work for the government and they work for library systems. I mean, they're from Zing Train teaches people from all kinds of industries.
Yeah. And do you see a lot of crossover, a lot of opportunities that the bakery stories are helping these folks?
Absolutely. I mean, I try not to use too many bakery stories per se, but you know, you can't, I mean, because by the end of these 2-day seminars, which is what most of them are, you know, people leave saying, oh, you know, it's just amazing. People are just the same.
Yeah.
Whether they're working in a tech firm or for a newspaper or in a bakery, you have a lot of the same issues, challenges organizationally, slightly different contexts.
There's a lot
in common.
Yeah. I was thinking about that just because with some of the coaching work that I'm doing these days, you know, there's nobody there involved in baking at all. Right. But they've all been to bakeries enough that they can imagine what it is you're telling them. Right.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned healthcare. I was working with in a group and there were some folks there doing like crazy startup medical things that I don't even understand what it is. Right. You know, and they're like, you're never going to understand what this is. So we have nothing to talk about was the resistance at the start, you know, and then you start after a while, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to tell you a story about, like you say, you know, the manager dealing with somebody that's coming in late all the time or what, you know, just whatever happens to me. It's like, oh, okay. All right. We're all dealing with people here. It all boils down to, people working together to make something bigger than them, whether it's, you know, I don't know, gold plated, whatever devices for cancer or, you know, a really nice cake. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. It's
why did you stop doing your bakery?
Well, I stopped the retail bakery. We got an offer to buy us out and we took it. Because we were in that kind of too small place where we had, well, we'd been open for 5 years. My wife and I were still working like full shifts and both of us had to be there for, for full shifts or else we weren't going to get the product out, even though we were supporting a team. And so we could never kind of get away enough to, and get sales high enough that we could get the team to do the work and we could kind of work with it. And we could never kind of get over that hump. Mm-hmm. And we had, in that process, we'd gone through sort of two full crews, two excellent crews, but just, okay, I've been here 2 years. I want to move on, or young folks getting married and moving to another town, or, and we had just been through that transition again. I was like, oh, I don't have the energy to start a whole new team, even if it's four people. Right.
Yes.
And
yes.
So we had said, well, okay, we were going to make it, we were going to try and make it till Christmas. We were going to make it till Christmas. And then in January, when it's cold, we were going to close for a bit, take a break, and then get the team back together and say, okay, as a group, we got to figure this out. Right. Because, you know, if one of us gets sick or our parents get sick, like we're all out of a job here. We, you know, we got to make this thing work. Mm-hmm. And, but in September of that year, we had an offer to just, a coffee shop needed to expand, needed a kitchen, bought us out, and then said, you know, we'll buy the gear. We'll even take on your staff, to do our coffee shop kitchen, like not our bakery. Mm-hmm. And so we said, okay, well, we can figure this out with the pressure of debt and the team and everything, or we can take a break and then figure it out and reopen, you know, somewhere right. else in a different way.
Right.
And while I was looking for new places to reopen and, okay, we're going to rebuild the team, my wife said, you know, Mark, I never want to do this again.
And I said, that's pretty clear.
I said, well, I'm glad we knew, because both of us, we got so tired that we weren't ourselves anymore. Like we were, yeah. You know, and so I wouldn't say it was putting a strain on the marriage, but the way we were talking to each other, it was gonna, yeah. You know, yeah. So yeah. If it didn't yet, yeah. It was gonna. So we said, well, let's take right. this as a blessing. So I did my, so then I had a brick oven. So I did a solo pre-orders only, just come to the backyard and pick up thing for 3 years for former customers and stuff. And I actually uh-huh. found that to be my happy spot, uh-huh. because I was awake enough to chat with everybody when they came in. And I found I got a lot of good from talking to the people that were eating what I was making. Right.
Right.
And so yeah. for me, that was my happy place. But then when our kids grew up last year and took off, we've always been dreaming of coming to the coast. So we came out to the West Coast. And now I was just thinking about this. This is 2020 was the first year in 15 that I haven't made any money selling any baking, you know, everything's like, it was, you know, there wasn't, you know,
yeah,
not even a hot cross bun sale or something, like nothing. Yeah. It was like, that's weird. So, yeah. So I am out of balance now and I recognize that. So something's got to give for me, but that was why we closed the retail space, just because, yeah, I just, we couldn't get through that hump. We were too big for the amount of sales that we had, uh-huh. and too small to, you know, and I had a lot of hangups about debt, you know, cause we financed the whole bakery with a line of credit based on our home equity. Like it was a home equity mm-hmm. loan. Mm-hmm. And that pressure of, you know, this, the house is riding on this place.
Yes. That's a lot of pressure.
That was too much for me. That was too big of a bet. And so yeah. I learned that about myself, right? That if I was going to do it again, I'll always put pressure on myself. But it's not going to be house pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, the bakery is we started so long ago that you couldn't even be an LLC in 92. So it's a corporation. So I've not had that pressure until I bought some more shares several years ago.
Right.
And so I have a personal loan. And when the pandemic hit, I did have that thought, oh my God, I could lose my home.
Yeah.
And that was not a good feeling. So I can imagine for 5 years having the bakery that would be very stressful.
And I'm we were both very kind of are very emotional people from the perspective of like the relationships that we have. And so the staff that we had, you know, it didn't work out and someone would have to leave, or we just really love these folks. And so now there's pressure. It's like, it's not Cindy and I and our two kids. It's Cindy and I are two kids and these six other people that we're responsible for. It was, at one point it was like 13 people. And we were like, okay, I can't be everyone's parent, because I can't just, like, there is, the bank of mom is not big enough for all these folks. Yeah. I would say for me, honestly, it was a bit of a, I think we opened a kind of naively, you know, I think we were successful. I think we really hit, well, I know we hit a need in the community and we had a strong attachment with the folks in the community and that. And, you know, to the point where in hindsight, the way, you know, like you're talking about social media, it's like we had a strong communication with our customers and I could have leveraged that a bit more. Like, if we had some customers that I know that if we'd have said to half a dozen people, look, you know, we're in trouble. We need some financial help or some, you know, take on a partner or something to keep this thing going for the long term. Mm-hmm. Never would have had the guts to do that in 2015, but now I would have asked the question, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, it just, but when you're in the thick of it, you just don't see those options.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a family that was in business. So I think I'm a little hardened to some of these things.
Yeah.
I at the dinner table, I knew about the loan for all the inventory of my father's business. My father had a business. He had several. One of them went bankrupt. I was, you know, at the table through many discussions between my parents about how did this happen? What are we going to do? How is he going to pay off this debt? You know, so
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and for us, it was funny because like we never had a problem making pay. Well, we had one problem making payroll till I understood cash flow better. But then, but you know, it was getting to, we were either paying down our loan, paying our staff, or investing in new equipment and that kind of stuff. And we could do two out of three at any given time. Right. And so I was worried about, I was just projecting out and saying like, you know, all this gear is going to need replacing before I've paid it off. And that doesn't seem right.
This is not going to work out well.
Yeah. Like I'm not Warren Buffett here, but I can see that not working.
Yeah. Right. Yes. I mean, I think for us, what we've always said was we were so, so fortunate to be born with this customer of Zingerman's Delicatessen.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because it was the biggest gift.
Yeah.
Because what we made for them could have pretty much sustained us. And although the Zingerman's businesses are not required to buy from one another, there's a strong desire to try to work together.
Sure.
So they could at any moment today or any day say, we're not going to buy from you anymore. But so I that allowed this bakery to have a security net right from the beginning, I would say.
Yeah.
That was really a very, very, very big gift.
Yeah. Well, and I can imagine the knowledge that's been built up over time with all the new additions and stuff that there's a bit of a process that you guys have figured out about starting something new and how long of a runway do we have to make this thing pay off? And what are our, what are our marks to know? So that it's always going to be an emotional decision to say, maybe the chocolate shop isn't working, you know, or whatever it happens to be. Right. Mm-hmm. But because you've had the chance to repeat it a bunch. Right. And you know, my folks had a service station when I was a kid, but it was it was like a franchise and they did it for 8 years and then they went back to farming. And so, you know, it was like nice and tight and done, but the, So I got a bit of a taste, but that's one thing that I'm always fascinated by is the folks that are able to somewhat rationally say, well, okay, here's a new area I want to get into. How am I going to do that? And how am I going to fund it? And when will I know that it's working? You know, and then I can do another. And so the Zingerman model of that sort of family of business model, and even, you know, talking to Ann and Jen in Colorado, they were talking about a coffee shop that they did that with, and that's now mm-hmm. part of their thing, but it's not their thing. They've got someone running the coffee shop and they're just a right. partner of, and I'm like, oh, this sounds awesome. Right. Cause you're seeing the need and you're doing the things to serve the need, but it's not all on you, one person. Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's still always hard though, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and some of us are, you know, it's funny that you bring up the chocolate shop because that was not going well. And
oh dear.
I was, it's good. And I was a partner in it and it spun out of the bakery. And at a certain point, and I wasn't running it, mm-hmm. but I had shares. And at a certain point I said, look, I don't think this is going to work. But why don't we set a date by which we make a decision, a go, no go decision?
Right, yeah.
Because we've been working on it and we've been hoping and we've been trying and we've been changing things and changing pricing, changing sizing, trying different marketing things. You know, my gut is this is not going to work. And something very fundamental, either it has to close or we have to do something very, very different, mm-hmm. fundamentally different. And let's set a go, no go date. Well, not everybody wanted to do that. It's a very emotional thing to let go of something and to stop something.
Well, and the thing that, reflecting on it, because it's been, I've got a bit of distance now from Orange Boot, from the retail bakery, that closing the bakery for me was completely, it was personal failure. It wasn't business failure. It wasn't a combination that didn't work, or it wasn't like a puzzle mm-hmm. that didn't get solved this time. Mm-hmm. It was like, no, it was personal failure. And it took quite a few years to get over that, maybe six. And it's been 6 years since we closed, it's that kind of a thing. Cause you get that kind of emotional attachment to it that it's like the chocolate shop may not be working. There's probably someone in that group saying, that means I'm not working, right? I'm not working out. And that's so hard. Yeah.
Right. And what's so interesting to me is I don't have that issue.
Yeah.
I tell a story about it. My story is I'm the youngest of four. I was always the worst at everything because I was the youngest. I was failing all the time. I lost all the games because I was the youngest. And then it's been good to fail early and fail often, mm-hmm. and fail not very big because I got used to it. And I didn't take it. It didn't mean I wasn't lovable or I mm-hmm. couldn't have friends. It was just, you don't always succeed.
Yeah.
So I can talk about these things with a little more distance. And so it's interesting hearing you say that. And I don't always think about how personal it is for people. And to me, like if the bakery doesn't work out in some way, or we make a product that doesn't work, or an area mm-hmm. of the bakery is not working, I often, for me, it's like, sometimes I worry that I'm too cold, but it's strategic. Okay. Well, either we didn't have the skills, but that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. Or it's a bad market situation, or who knows, we're ahead of the time. That's a nice idea, but it just didn't work. Okay, move on.
Yeah,
move on.
That detaching yourself from the outcome is huge, right? Like this idea that, you know, we're going to make the best decision that we can with all what we have right now. And now that we've made the decision, it's like a bet, right? The bet could work, it could not work, but it's like, well, we made a good decision and we'll make another good decision about keeping it open or closing it. And that's what I'm striving for now, for sure. In everything is that proper level of detachment from the outcome. So we made the best decisions we could. and whether or not it worked, it's like we still made a good decision. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it even like even with closing, you know, because some of our customers were so upset when we closed, but I was able to reach out with them. I baked for them for 3 more years before we moved out here. And it was like, and it was great because I got to see them more at my house than I ever did at the bakery. Because I'd gone home by the time they came in most of the time. So over time, I think they even found a bit of a win-win, aside from the fact that they couldn't get croissants from me, but you know, that's all right.
So one question for you that we haven't, you know, how did your children react to you closing the bakery?
Oh my gosh. That's, I'm so glad you asked that. Because my son, he's 25 now, and he's a very level-headed guy, right? And he's like, no, you have to. You're making yourselves crazy. He's a warm person, but he's good at making cold, rational decisions. You know?
Yeah.
My daughter, who's a year and a half younger, when we opened the bakery, she was so angry because it meant that we weren't able to go to all her hockey games, and she was in high school, and we did, and it was hard to get to all of the stuff. And it's like, you're wrecking my life by having the bakery. Then she started working in the bakery and found her niche working in the back. She didn't like serving customers, but she was like our after school afternoon prep person for the next day. So now when we're going to close the thing, we're like, we think, and she'll be happy. We have more time for her. You're ruining my life again because you know, I finally found my place and I'm happy here and stuff. And now she was like, you're pulling the rug out from under me. So we can't win with her, but we laugh about it now, you know, and, you know, and since she's, you know, she's got her education degree, she's in England now, she's left us and teaching and stuff. And it's like, well, what the heck?
She's ruining your life. Yeah.
She moved to England. Then we moved out here and she was mad at us. It's like, you sold the house. Like, that's the house I grew up in. It's like, but you're in England. You're not even living there. So yeah. So we've just come to terms with the fact we're never going to win with her. And any decision we make is not going to be popular because it's change.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And if she can finally own that herself.
Yeah. And then she started baking cookies for the folks that were coming to the backyard. And so she had her little side business, having cookie orders alongside the bread orders and stuff. And so she was doing fine. every Saturday, she'd come out, tootle out to the garage, and I would hand her a bunch of money from her share of the cookie sales. And then she'd have a weekend. So it was all good.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. These things can be such family affairs.
Well, and it was a four person operation, like right from the first get go, you know, whether it was assembling shelves with Ben or, you know, the kids work in the front that for the first weekends we were open, it was like our two kids and their two of their friends from high school that, you know, 5 minutes before we opened, showed them how to work the cash register and away we go. Right. And I was pulling loaves out of the oven. It was nuts. Right. But they did it. And my son ran the front and my daughter ran the back in the afternoon, and it was great. Yeah. Wow. So I'm so glad we did it. Like that's the thing that even in the moment, it was like, that had a lot to do with why we opened the place was because I worked for my folks when I was in high school, my kids were in high school. We said, we have to do it now. Cause I want their first part-time job to be in the family business, even if it's a short-term family business. Right. Cause you know, we weren't thinking short term at the time, but you know, but I'm grateful and they're grateful for the experience, I know. So yeah.
That's good. That's great.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks. I could talk to you for a month, but I'll come out and see you maybe. But
that would be great. Please do.
It's just been such a joy talking with you, Amy. It really has.
Yeah, you too, Mark. It's nice to meet you after all this time of knowing about you.
Yeah, well, and thank you for the thanks for the stories and thanks also for, thanks for the chat about sort of the transition that you're going through now with Frank leaving and stuff. Cause I don't know if folks think about that stuff until they're in it, but I'm glad to hear you reflect on it now. It really is.
Yeah. Right. I think we spend a lot of time talking about the beginning years and getting going and not as much time about the later years.
Yeah.
And I, although I'm not talking about per se getting out of the business, but as my father, who was, I told you, had his own business, he said, people often talk about how hard it is to start a business, but it's really hard to end a business well too.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to end the business, but you know, within 10 years or so, I may be ending my role in the business and how to do that well. So, and I know there are other artisan bakers out there who have already done it recently and who are probably thinking about doing it. And it's, there's a lot to think about and talk about in that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yep. Well, yeah. Cause it's a generational thing, right? You know, like Jeffrey's retired at King Arthur and there's other folks come through and it's kind of cool though to be part of this for long enough to see it change, right? Because like the first wave when I got involved, it was people I read about in books, and then I over the years I got to meet folks, you know, and it's like, okay, this is cool. And now as they're shifting and new folks are coming up, it's like, oh, okay, now I get to meet them too, you know. And it's nice to see. I kind of keep mental notes of who's been teaching who. You know, and who, and then that sort of web of bakers, especially where we live, and that it's so cool to see. So,
it is
awesome.
Well, good. Well,
thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Awesome stuff. That was Amy. That was a lot of fun. I'm very glad to get the chance to talk with her. You know, it was a lot of fun for me. I'm fascinated by the folks that, you know, are building something big or have built something big, like Amy has with the bakehouse, and how her role and how her days have changed as the business grows and how it might change again in the future and all of that. I found fascinating. And, you know, it's fun to me to find somebody with some Canadian roots as well, who's made great success down south. It doesn't just happen for musicians and comedians, I guess. It happens for bakers as well. So that's pretty cool. So I'm very glad that Amy took the time to be on the show today. So that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed the chat. We're going to have another talk coming up next week. Right on schedule. Things are moving along in that regard. If you want to talk, if you want to connect up, just drop me an email, mark@riseuppod.com. If you head to riseuppod.com, there are 130 plus episodes of this podcast that you can listen to. They're all there for you. Keep you busy for a couple of days anyways. And until next week, when we have a brand new show, I hope you have a great week. Bake lots. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Happy baking. Bye-bye.